This is module 15, the Paramitas, and the Paramita for tonight is called Transcendent Exertion. This is talk 4. It is October 6, 2016. My name is Michael Levin. The reading is chapter 30 of the Profound Treasury, pages 238 to 248. So, having said all that, the theme for this evening is joy. So it's about time we come to that. The fourth paramita is a moment of really major change in the quality of the path. It's like cresting a hill and having a vast new perspective opening up. Shantideva, we may say something about Shantideva. This is his book, The Way of the Bodhisattva, and it is fairly Indian in style, and we haven't used it for that reason, but it's an excellent source on the paramitas. So Shantideva calls the fourth paramita heroic perseverance. And he says, heroic perseverance means delight in virtue. So this is a major transition point. Before this, the path was had the quality of an upward struggle. We have to try harder. We have to be more aware, we have to do better, and there's a huge effort going uphill. So now instead of an uphill struggle where we're pushed by fear of samsara or having to struggle on, now we're pulled forward by the enthusiasm of the journey to enlightenment. So the whole quality at this point changes. Practice, in fact, has become quite delightful. It no longer feels like a burden at all. And every time we're reminded of practice, it feels wonderful, a chance to move forward. So this is a big turning point. And this is, in fact, the difference between the first three paramitas, which are the uphill push, and the second set of three paramitas, where our prajna, or wisdom, is increasing, and that gives us a lot of enthusiasm for actually accomplishing the bodhisattva path. Practice has, in fact, become delightful. So what is it that has changed? What is different? Does anyone want to make a guess or feel they picked something up from the reading that they want to express about this? You don't have to, but... What's different? So, yes.
One thing he says on page 239, exertion helps you to destroy the whole range of egohood. A view in solidity is a big deal. I don't know if that's a piece of it, that if you're letting go of ego, it's not about me being better at practice.
Yeah. So, but it's become more real somehow. Right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so when I was a child, I read a story, I think, called The Little Engine That Could. Has anyone ever heard about that?
Oh, yeah. Famous book.
You know it. Sounds like. Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Depends on our age. All right. So this engine was a real Mahayana engine. That is, loaded with heavy freight cars filled with gifts for children. And the children are on the other side of the mountain. And it was very important to fulfill his bodhisattva aspiration and get these toys to the children. So he had to tow many cars, and he had to tow them up the hill. And the hill was a terribly steep hill, sort of an impossibly steep one for one tiny little engine. They probably should have assigned three great big powerful locomotives, but there he was. One tiny engine having to pull all these cars up the hill. Right?
That's really good.
Yeah.
That's my idea.
And the little engine said, I think I can. I think I can. I know I can. I know I can. And the little engine put up the maximum possible effort. He pushed on up the hill when it seemed absolutely impossible. And finally he came to the top of the hill, and he could see the other side, and he couldn't give up at that point. He had to work even harder to keep going, but at that point everything changed, because he saw that he could make it, that he had the strength, he was going to keep going, and it would the momentum would now start to be in his favor. So that's sort of one image of it. We're always talking about vehicles in the Mahayana. What kind of vehicle do we have? And is it a little vehicle for me, or is it a big vehicle that is working for the benefit of all sorts of people?
Or is it a little vehicle working for the benefit of all sorts of people, in the case of a little engine?
Right, but his vehicle included all those cars.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, analogies are never perfect.
That was awesome.
But, so there he was, cresting the hill. So, cresting the hill, a new vision has opened up. A new level of wisdom has kicked in, inspired by a much bigger vision. Before this, we might in fact contemplate, well, maybe I could take a little break from the Dharma at some point. I need a rest, so there's a little part of my life that isn't Dharma, and I could go rest there, right? And then come back to it or something. So, are there any places that Dharma hasn't reached? So at this point there's more wisdom. With this more wisdom we see that there are no more, there is no part of our life that isn't Dharma. That there's no corner, there's no little interaction, there's no, it's not that there isn't a nap or a watching television or having fun or anything. They're still there. But we see that there's not a single part of our life that isn't permeated by the Dharma. And furthermore, nor should there be. It doesn't make any sense to have a hidden thing that's private. We wouldn't even want it. So there's no desire to turn back. So every evening when we come here, we say something that starts with, grant your blessing so that my mind may be one with the Dharma. And that's got lots and lots of levels. At first it's an annoyance. You know, why do they make us say that or recite that? Why do we do that? Then maybe we don't quite get it, but we could start to get curious. Why does my mind want to be one with the Dharma? And here, finally, my mind is one with the Dharma. And we could look on the rest of that, and we see that our mind is one with the Dharma, therefore we are free to progress along the path, and so on. So there's really many, many levels of understanding of that simple little four dharmas of Gampopa that we recite. Many layers of clarifying what it means. And finally, a glimpse that confusion can't be anything else except enlightenment. It would be impossible. Confusion has to be enlightenment. So the obstacles have not gone away. However, the obstacles are now opportunities to leap into more intense practice. Anytime there's an obstacle, it's delightful because the obstacle is something to work with and to make and to understand and to have it manifest as genuine Dharma. Complete change of view or vision of what it's all about. And there's a very practical mark of this realization, and that is unconditional cheerfulness. One of the best things I ever heard about that was from Khandro Rinpoche, who said, "Do you really need to have a reason to be cheerful?" And that just hit me. No. We don't need any reason. Cheerfulness is our nature. We don't need any to be given something to be cheerful. We have no complaint. We have no reason to be resentful. We have no idea of blame or this isn't working out because someone did something to me when I was a child, or someone did something to me yesterday. There's no more. We're totally responsible and cheerfully responsible for being here right now and working with the situation. No expectations, no idea that if we work very hard someone will say, "Here, you've been working hard, now I'm going to support you." Maybe that won't happen at all. And still we're cheerful and have no complaint.
Or that it'll all work out in the end too.
It'll all work out or it won't work out.
That's right.
We don't know. We have no idea, but here we are, and we're delightfully working with it. And we're working very hard for the benefit of all sentient beings, as long as we understand that there are sentient beings to be worked with. So I'm not going to talk too long, but does anyone feel a need to comment at this point? No, you can just listen. Okay.
John?
Actually,
you know,
yes. I think it'd be helpful to talk about what it means to be cheerful for a second. Because I'm not sure. The connotation that brings to mind are pretty light and border on denial.
okay.
Right? There's a right.
What are you denying?
Well, I think the common, like when I think of people who are cheerful, I think of people who are bubbly and bright and smiling and positive.
Everything's okay.
Everything's okay.
Dope slap.
Well, maybe there are all. Also all of those things. But I think
Well, maybe everything's not okay. Maybe the cheerful is not putting on a smile.
Yeah.
But still there's no...
You mean cheerful as in willingness?
Willingness, that's good. No blame? No complaint?
Is it accepting with an eagerness to be in whatever is happening? Sort of acceptance, of openness to...
Total acceptance, yeah. But real total acceptance, which means there's no... there's nothing hidden. There's no... I kind of expect people will understand that I'm like this, or there's a little hidden bit of blaming someone for why I'm not really able to do it, or it's dropped. It's dropped completely. Yeah.
Do you remember this? And even remember this story that. Yet another Dharma story about a monk who fell off a cliff. And as he's falling to his death, he sees a beautiful flower growing out of the wall of the cliff. And his first reaction is, oh, how beautiful. And he continues.
And down he goes.
So I think we're talking about some kind of unconditional present, unconditional present.
Right. It's not a mood.
No, it's not a mood.
No.
Good point.
Well,
right.
That's like really good. It's right. Like if it's associated with Vipassana, it's a welcoming.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's not suppressing or pushing down or denying what's happening. It's just the word that's really difficult, cheerfulness. Yeah. It doesn't really fit that well.
Not in our definition.
No.
You're right, it sounds like a mood. And I think it's so much more than that.
Yeah.
It's just a...
It's not a mood.
It's a term that I agree that it's easy to get caught up on.
Well, Rinpoche used these terms in order for to help us think differently about our normal vocabulary rather than some kind of a posture.
Right.
We're talking about an open heart. I mean, when we discover open heart, we discover some sense of basic upbeat. Well, if we're really open, unconditionally open, we're not either nursing our wounds from whatever happened a moment ago or concerned about what's going to happen next. We're just willing to be here. I mean, this is so much connected with just the notion of openness, of unconditioned openness. So that's the Vipassana, is really the openness, the vastness. Where when things are vast, we can relax. Mm-hmm. And when we relax, this kind of quality of cheerfulness doesn't sound so foreign or cranked up.
That's a good bumper.
That's really great.
When it's fast, we can relax.
But it sounds like it's not the result of something like, oh, this wonderful thing just happened to me there.
Right.
So it's not a result, it's more of a state.
It's or beyond state, whatever. Yeah.
Beyond state.
So to review very briefly the paramitas we had so far, generosity was overcoming stinginess. Discipline was overcoming passion. Patience was overcoming
aggression,
right? Okay. Mm-hmm. So, one word, the obstacle to heroic perseverance. I really like that term. That's the one that... Shanti Devi used. The obstacle here is laziness. And laziness is, in some sense, easier to deal with. It's obvious. It's not like the layers and layers we have to go through to work with aggression or the more and more subtle levels of desire to work with discipline. It's obvious and right out there in our face that laziness is an obstacle to perseverance.
Is it ignorance or is it
laziness? It's laziness, okay? It's not ignorance here. We finally deal with ignorance completely by the sixth paramita, I think, but when wisdom is complete. But we're getting more and more wisdom. Remember that we've been alternating between shamatha and vipassana on the paramitas. So here it's not that there's anything new to do, but that there's something new in our understanding of what it is. It's vipassana, yeah.
I hadn't really thought about laziness so much before, but somehow it seems to me that laziness seems like it's like a blocking away, because if you're really open and then you have this acceptance, there's always all this stuff going on, and it seems like it would be invigorating, and it would be sort of the opposite of laziness. So laziness seems like an obstacle. But laziness isn't a lack of exertion, I think it's a block to exertion, because when you're, it's like when there's just all this, like the guy who was falling off the cliff. I mean, he was open and he saw the flower.
Uh-huh. Okay.
That was just my sense.
Yeah, I think that's right. So it's just a blocking.
Roberta has something.
Yes.
Yeah. Is being overwhelmed also laziness? I mean, I was looking at number one and number two, unable to get ourselves properly organized to accomplish what needs to be done.
Yeah, so
you can certainly identify with that. You're feeling, I've just been feeling overwhelmed lately and losing heart. I don't know, I mean. So being overwhelmed is laziness.
Yeah, so there are three of them in the list we're going to get to. You mentioned two of them so far, right?
Losing heart is one.
So one of the characteristics of being completely open and heroically persevering is that life is not boring. That is, if you have to get up and brush your teeth every day, or you have to get up and go to work and talk to a person who you don't particularly like to talk to, or whatever is going on, it's not as if life is a boring repetition. If we're completely opened and every moment is fresh, if you're brushing your teeth, this is a fresh moment. It's not like the last time you brushed your teeth. You're a new person. Your mind is different. Your understanding is evolving. And it's interesting to brush your teeth. And it's interesting to deal with each hassle as it comes up. There's a freshness in each situation, which I hope is a little better than having just one chance to eat a little berry. but the whole of one's life is opening up again and again and again.
Where does fear come into these three obstacles?
Are you going to answer that for us?
No. To me, fear is pervasive, and I'm surprised the word is not in here.
Oh, it is in here. Okay, so
did I miss it somewhere?
Okay, let's go into the laziness, the main obstacle to exertion, and we see three categories of it. The first one Roberta mentioned is just common laziness or casualness, not taking the trouble to get oneself together, so one is a bit disorganized. I'd like to have time to meditate in addition to everything else, but I didn't quite arrange it so that it happened. So we start to feel that the hassles are getting us a little bit down, and we don't, and we're not really in control of our life. So that is an obstacle to be aware of and to overcome. We actually can organize our life properly. We can make it happen, no matter what the circumstances. It doesn't mean that we can always go on a 6-week retreat, but we can always do something, which means we're on the path.
Question?
Yeah.
It's like, so laziness is kind of like being in the back seat of the car, talking about a vehicle again, in the back seat instead of being in the front seat driving.
You don't feel you're in control because you haven't organized it right.
But when you're lazy and all that, you're in the back seat, so you're kind of, you're not in control of the direction you're going.
There's a bit of passivity there, isn't there?
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. That's good. Okay. Yeah. Then there's a second one, which Roberta also mentioned, I believe, which is losing heart. If you read the text, you see that in the Tibetan, it really comes out as losing weight. That is, losing the weight of one's determination.
Is that what laylo? That's laylo, or is that sound? That's laziness.
Yeah, all three of them are called laylo.
Lelo, laylo.
Which is kind of funny. So this type of laylo is feeling I'm inadequate. It's a little different than just being not getting it together. I'm inadequate. I'm really not capable of being an enlightened bodhisattva, so why should I even try? That is a more depressing aspect of it. So we all know that we feel that way at times, and that can be worked with also. Because feeling that way is actually the flip side of waking up. It's a reaction or a fear of waking up. And I think fear was mentioned. Fear, there is definitely fear in going forward. And fear becomes fearlessness not by either running away or by charging recklessly forward. Fear becomes fearlessness by just persevering and going on and working until fear has turned into fearlessness. Not passively and not aggressively. There's a third type of laziness.
Before you go into that, Michael, I think what that last statement, giving up the reference point to the samsaric world we feel attached to. Mm-hmm. That's where the whole notion of just throwing in the towel comes, because we actually believe that all these formidable opponent elements are basically fundamentally more real than the truth of simply being present. And so we build up this huge construction of solidification, as we've talked about previously. And then we actually, instead of being able to make use of that, you basically just say, roll over and play dead, you know. So there's a point about deciding to view all these things as some kind of ally, where actually the fear becomes an ally to wake up. Ah, fear. If we can actually identify it. Then we can actually use it as a springboard to return to completely being here presently, as it is. That makes sense?
Yeah. Yep. So there's a third type, which probably most most of us aren't going to do, I don't think. And that it's called degraded laziness here, and it means just turning away and saying, I have other things I need to do, they're more important. It's more important to fight my enemies. It's more important to give up the Dharma and get more wealth or get more advantage. There are things in the world that I'm preoccupied with and I really don't have time for Dharma.
Isn't it also, because I thought that was a very interesting thing in the reading on that, isn't it also that just getting busy? I mean, could that be equated like just
yes,
like
it is busyness.
Overworking or whatever?
It is busyness, yeah. but sometimes we need to be properly busy. This is busyness that just gives up on Dharma. That's different than the fact that we may have to put a lot of effort into our job. And that's not wrong, as long as we're mindful that our life is shaped by Dharma and how we handle that job is part of Dharma. This is running away.
Mm-hmm. Busyness as an escape.
Mm-hmm. So like being a workaholic and just working all the time and not having time for vacation or anything and any enjoyment in life.
It's a form of avoidance, really.
Exactly, yeah. I gotta work.
Yeah.
It's also a form of sort of elaborating one's ego and contributing to that whole
solidification.
Yeah, I beg your pardon?
Solidification.
Yeah. So it actually has the effect of propping it up. Being really solidifying.
So since we've had three forms of laziness, so now we need three qualities of exertion, right?
All right.
So we can deal with all that. And the first one here is labeled suit of armor. Mm. One never takes off the suit of armor, and that suit of armor is simply the desire to attain enlightenment, that which is motivating us forward. We don't take it off. If we find it's off, we put it on right away. So the armor of exertion is connected with joy. It's joyful to always have the armor of wanting enlightenment and being willing to work for it.
Michael, what is the next sentence mean? Whatever we experience is like a fog and not all that substantial. Does that mean whatever we experience that is samsara or not dharma?
Yeah, the fog here is the obstacles.
The obstacles.
And it's saying that we work through obstacles and we find that by continually working with them, we actually do penetrate them, not by avoiding them and not by saying, I'm going to conquer this, but just by steadily working despite obstacles and working with the obstacles, we see that they aren't quite as solid as we thought. So I think that's why the image of fog is there.
So the obstacles are a fog.
Yeah.
So it's like you. I can just think of this morning because it was foggy this morning. Mm-hmm. But driving along, going through the fog, going through it and breaking through it, so it's like, oh, this fog, I got to stop. I can't drive anymore.
Right. So you didn't stop.
I got to keep on moving, and I can break through to the other side.
You didn't stop, but you didn't say I'm going to race ahead and beat it out either, did you?
Right. No.
That wouldn't work. Mm-hmm. So it's again, it's the steadiness and the equanimity which is working through obstacles.
Mm-hmm. I've found from my practice that if I pick just one or two things to focus on in my daily life, like recognizing when I'm, one particular thing is recognizing when I'm building a story. Mm-hmm. And when I face something that's very challenging in my life, causes stress, and then the stress comes up, and I'm trying to be aware that I'm wrapping a story around this. And when I'm aware of it, going, okay, can I let go of the story and just be there with the feeling of the energy of it? And not burying the story, just stopping the story, letting the energy of the anxiety or whatever just be there. And what I found, when I take the time to do that, that the energy is there, and it's a very different kind of energy when it lacks a story, and it becomes insubstantial. And the longer I can stay with that and not get reattached to the story, which is so much easier said than done, the more insubstantial it becomes. And often it will just kind of not go away, but it will fade quite a bit.
Start, yeah. So you can't defeat it all at once with one
aggressive
leap. But you just, again, it's equanimity.
Yes.
You're going to keep working on that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the armor of exertion is joyful. And then the second of these qualities is called action here. And it's described as making an effort to overcome kleshas. So we still have to work with kleshas. Making an effort to develop virtue. A virtue is an interesting word. The word virtue is related to the English words like virtue and virtuous, and has a, but also it's related to English words like virile. So virtue has a very strong, it's a connotation of strength. It's not just virtue in the sense of being good, it's virtue in the sense of having the strength to persevere, to be with what the situation is and to keep working. If you read the text, there's actually five categories going on there. I don't think I want to go into them here, but you're welcome to. I'm going to be finished in hopefully a minute. And the third one is making an exceedingly great effort to work with others. So just like that little engine who really wants to bring the toys to the children, we're going to keep working. We're going to keep on the effort to work with others. And we're going to be work very hard at doing that. And the last one, all it says is never being satisfied. We don't say, well, now I've exerted myself enough, so I can go relax a little. So there's a sense of not being separate from the Dharma. If one is not separate from the Dharma, then there's no need for a self to relax. Relax in the sense of needing a vacation. There's all kinds of relaxation which is beneficial. That's a little different. I think we get the sense of that. Mm-hmm.
Question about the the sentence under number two, second is developing five categories, perseverance, and I understand joy, but immovability and not changing one's mind. That sounds like in certain circumstances, if you're really open, you would be movable and you would change your mind.
Yeah, so you can't find anything formulaic there, can you? That is, there are times when one's mind is wrong and you got to change it, right? But
yeah.
here, what is the sense here? We're working for enlightenment, right? And I'm not going to change my mind about that.
I'm keeping that goal in mind.
Yeah.
I see.
What's the next one? Let's go through the next two. What comes after that one?
Oh, not genuine, non-arrogance.
Ah, okay. So, finally, we can't... Not changing one's mind is not some stubborn show of arrogance that we're going to hold on to. This is where I plant my feet. Fuck you. So it all makes sense. It's flexible. It can't be taken as a simplistic formula. At every point, wisdom is operating more and more and more.
How can you unity, once you're on a path, I know for myself, I am not separate from the Dharma, even when I think I am. It's always there. And then maybe there's moments of clarity, oh, okay, I was just in this fog, but the Dharma was with me, I was a part of the Dharma. So how do I separate from the Dharma at any point?
Is that a question of how do I do something or why does something happen?
No, I was questioning the sentence.
There's a sense of not being separate from the Dharma.
So it's just more an attitude of feeling like you're separate from the Dharma?
Of not being separate from the Dharma.
Of not being separate.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's a sense of not being separated from the Dharma. So I think that's the positive, which is the answer, which is instead of now I've exerted myself enough, you have a sense that you're never separated from the Dharma. I think that's what it's saying, is a kind of a response to the previous sentence.
Even if it seems like we're separated, in some sense the Dharma has never left us.
We're always haunted. It's kind of that kind of quality.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I understand what it helps with. Thank you.
It is confusing.
Well, there's lots of things going on here that anyone can bring up.
The thing I, probably because it's the last thing I read before I went to bed or something, but that very last bit about the lump.
Oh, yeah.
What is the idea? You know, when you think, like, this guy has this great metaphor going on. I don't know.
I told Michael to take it off the bottom of the page. I just talked about it. I said, holy cow, what is it?
Oh, the lump.
I didn't get it either.
What?
Chewing that lump.
It'd be a very chewy situation.
I think maybe it means I did it.
Okay, go ahead.
It's about, like, it's you're, like, really working with something. You know, it's like you're really savoring it and really
chewing it up.
Yeah.
Processing? Is it processing? Like processing?
But there's something specifically where he says the lump between your past and future states of mind. Mm. What is that then?
The present in your mind.
Well,
is it?
Yeah. The lump is, first of all, described as something that might. Lump is, in some sense, obstacle, and it could be health obstacle or something like that. I kind of think.
Obstacle? Yeah. It's the juice of your life.
I don't think it's obstacle. It's
swallowing your claims.
Read that again. One more.
I'll read the whole thing.
Okay, read it.
Not the whole thing, but this is the question. You find that the lump in your jaw, the lump between your past and future states of mind, is very chewy, but it's also quite good. It is quite real. Don't try to get rid of it. Don't take it out of your mouth and throw it in the garbage pile. Chew it and swallow it. It is the juice of your life. You are swallowing your kleshas, your ayatanas, your dhatus, and, sorry guys, your skandhas. All those things contain pretty good chewing gum. It is very basic. You don't need too many metaphysical interpretations. Just feel it. You are chewing right now, on the spot. Look at it, chew it, and swallow it. You will feel that you have done something at last. Something very, something at last, this very day. Such chewing is connected with shamatha and vipassana practice and everything within them. It is very simple and delightful.
So we are not going to define all those words.
No,
but it's but like obstacles.
Your obstacles are opportunities to grow.
Everything that occurs in your life is obstacle, joy, or misery. It's delightful because it's the path.
Yeah, don't try to throw it away, and don't try to aggressively leap over it and say I've conquered it. Just hold it there. Chew it.
So nowhere in our what we've studied so far talks about getting rid of kleshas, of neuroses, of any of these completely, unbearable manifestations of stupidity we encounter continuously in our experience, right? We're not trying to get rid of it. We're not trying to destroy it. We're willing to really work with it. I mean, this is a very interesting way he put that.
Yeah.
this lump I've got in my... Okay, it started here, and now it's moving into my mouth. And how do I... That's what I've got. I've got it here. I can chew it. And I can actually fully chew it and digest it. Because this, as we learn more, contains the kernel of enlightened mind. It's not separate from whatever arises in our experience.
Confusion to wisdom.
It's like everything we want to get rid of, that's everything that's our gold. That is really what we've got. It's like everything we just don't like about ourselves. That's the way in. That is the way in.
So now we've finally gotten to the last lines of Genpopa's four. Uh-huh. Grant you blessings so that confusion may dawn as wisdom. Mm-hmm. There is nothing else that is wisdom other than our confusion. Mm-hmm. It's the only thing we have. It is our wisdom.
It seems to me it's connected to cheerfulness that we started with.
Yeah.
Because you take the whole lump. Mm-hmm.
Is the lump?
And it's chewing.
Okay, so
it's
say a little more. Yeah. I want to hear you say
it
something.
Says, yeah.
Not a question, but say it.
Yeah.
Say what, okay.
What you're telling me how to speak?
No,
I don't know what you're asking.
You just said, yeah, what you just said is very good.
Oh, to me, swallowing the lump, it can be connected to cheerfulness. Because you swallow everything. It becomes part of you.
Yeah.
And cheerfulness is, it calls it joyfully. Uh-huh. I'm sorry, I misunderstood what you said.
No, that's great.
Is the lump the bad stuff as well as the good stuff?
Seems to be everything. Yeah.
It's not just the bad stuff we don't like about ourselves.
No.
It's everything in your life.
Take it all.
I'm thinking of the neuroses, the conflicts.
Oh,
I'm thinking of the cow ruminating
through all the stuff. I know.
I've done so.
It's
through all
the stuff.
Right.
Completely. Be the cow.
Or meditate. Probably have a cow.
A cow.
Yeah. Is that the reason why cows are so revered? Because they chew their cud and they're always chewing,
Well, I don't know. Are they enlightened or are they stuck in samsara? Yeah. We've been here for a while, aren't we?
When we come back as cows, we'll know.
Right.
Or not.
So it's been said, and it's been said in this chapter, that paramita practice is all about action and activity. Mm-hmm. And yet, practice, we always face this little double thing. Practice is important because if we didn't practice, we wouldn't be moving forward in the activity, right? If we didn't have time, the practice somehow is sparking it. So we are practitioners and active practitioners. What else?
Why to lock the shoe?
What else?
Well, I think you covered it.
We could.
Well, one thing we didn't talk about, which is I mentioned, that whole sense of, it says, on the whole, all three types of laziness should be overcome by having a sense of urgency and directness. And there's this famous image of a snake falling into your lap. And when the snake falls into your lap, you just don't look at it, and nice little snake, you jump up, right? As well as if your hair's on fire, that's another expression. Practice as if your hair were on fire. So you're just, that urgency to overcome, here it's talking about the urgency of overcoming laziness. So I think that's an interesting little piece there.
Where is that?
That's on page 244 at the bottom.
I think that snake in your lap comes from the Shantideva.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. Well, yeah, Shantideva really runs through every talk we give. I think we'll have to do a program on Shantideva at some point.
Yeah, I don't know who Shantideva is.
Oh. Well, he's living in us.
You want to take 2 minutes to hear a miracle story? Okay,
just say 2 minutes about Shantideva. We have a few minutes.
Okay, so he was Indian. He lived probably around 700 or so AD. So he's not ancient. He's well within what we know.
Pretty old.
It's
older than we are.
That's starting to get into almost modern medieval history. You see, did I mark this place?
Pema does a great talk on Shantideva's Way of the Bodhisattva.
Right.
Awesome audio program.
Program, yeah.
She goes through line item by line item and talks about it.
All right, he was just doing the three essentials, right?
720 of them, right?
Yeah. That's why it's pretty easy.
Well, just tell the story. Well, who was he? He went to.
Okay. So.
Wasn't he the one who they thought was lazy?
Yeah, he thought he was extremely lazy.
So there are many miraculous parts to the story, but in this particular one, he entered as a novice monk into Nalanda University, a very famous university in Bengal. And no one thought very much of him because he didn't take part in the practices, he didn't do the work, he didn't study, he didn't do talks when people took time doing different talks. It was said that all he did was eat, sleep, and putter around.
And they had to
defecate.
Eat, sleep, and
defecate.
Yeah, okay, in this story, it's just in this story, it doesn't say that, it says puttering around. But whatever it is. That was all he did, and no one thought very much of him. The monks wanted to get rid of him as a duffer and no good. So they made a plot that everyone would have to take turns giving a talk, and they were sure that he would not want to do that, and he would be driven out and leave. But in fact, he was perfectly willing to give a talk. He asked for a little throne to be made for him, and they thought this was hilarious. This idiot wants to get up on a throne to give his talk. None of us even demand that. So his turn came, and he got up, and the throne seemed to be very high at that point, and no one was sure how he got onto the throne.
They made a really high throne for him, right?
He couldn't get on it. Yeah,
but he somehow got up there.
So somehow he was on top of the throne, and he said, Would you like me to give a talk on something you've already heard of, or would you like to hear something new? And they said, oh, we want to hear something new. So he started to give the talk, and the talk was basically what we call the Bodhicharya, which is here translated as the way of the Bodhisattva. So he gave the talk, and it went on for quite some time, and people were astonished, and those who had good memory were listening attentively, trying to, and some of them were good enough to actually remember every word of it. And then he got to the final chapter, and at that point it appeared as if Manjushri was the Bodhisattva of wisdom was sitting next to him, and then both he and Manjushri rose up into the sky, but his voice still kept coming from the top of the throne. And then he finished the talk and he wasn't seen anymore. So
he left school.
He left school, evidently. So those who were, so those who were very good at listening started to write it down. And some of them, when they wrote it down, had 7 chapters, but some of them had 10 chapters, and they weren't sure which was the right version. So someone was sent out to find him. In the meanwhile, they heard he was living somewhere way in the south in some other situation. And they sought him out, and he said, the one with the 10 chapters is the correct one. That's the one you should use. And by the way, there's 2 other very important texts that I wrote, and you'll find them in the hidden in the thatch of the room I was in at Nalanda. Go look for them.
Wow.
And that's not the end, because then he was seen here and there doing all kinds of miracles, but that's kind of the juiciest part of the story.
Do you know who he is now?
Now we know a lot about
him.
You're
off
on a high note.
You have to end it there?
Well, when he's up on the throne there, he's looking at the left, and he's like, yeah, it's perfect. Like, wow.
Well, the 9th chapter is pretty far out.
Truly far out. The wisdom, transcendent wisdom. You're going to talk about that. That's your
I am dropping deep into drama.
Were the Paramitas, was this written by Shanti Deva?
They basically go back to him, yeah.
Okay, so...
But we're using other commentaries.
Trungpa Rinpoche taught this, but it came from Shanti Deva.
There's a whole lineage of other
people who've written on it.
Who've talked about it.
Trungpa Rinpoche was following that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It was always his own juicy way of saying it, but there are many commentaries that he had access to, and they go back in Tibet where they're accurately recorded, and then they go back sort of into India where they assume a more mythical quality.
Thank you.
Shall we end here?